Chapter 2. The Children's Encyclopedia. One cold, bright December morning, when I was 8 years old, I opened my pyjama jacket, pulled up my vest up to my chin, and stood on a chair in front of the window so that the doctor could peer more closely at my chest. It was covered with dull red spots. Making me turn round, he scrutinised my back. The same dull red spots. "Scarlet fever," he said briefly. "He'll have to go to hospital." Though I had had measles and whooping cough, as well as influenza, this was the first time it had been necessary for me to be removed to hospital, and I was filled with apprehension. Besides, it was only a week before Christmas, and I was deeply disturbed by the prospect of missing any of the customary festivities. To assuage my fears, a copy of Alice in Wonderland was taken prematurely from its hiding place in a cupboard, with the assurance that, if I was a good boy and went to the hospital without making a fuss, I would definitely be home in time to open the rest of my presents on Christmas morning. When the ambulance arrived, therefore, I left quite cheerfully, clutching the Alice in Wonderland, and declaring loudly that I would be back in 4 or 5 days. Perhaps I would not have gone so quietly had I known that I should be away for 5 weeks, and that, even when I did eventually return, it would be to an existence quite different from the one to which I was accustomed, and that I should be allowed no festivities of any sort for several years. The ward, where I found myself in bed an hour later, contained about 40 boys of different ages, all with scarlet fever. At first I took refuge behind the Alice in Wonderland, now my sole memento of home. But soon my nervousness abated. I became used to the disciplined routine of hospital life, and started making friends with some of the other boys. Our day began very early. Long before the short winter day had dawned, two cheery cleaners, clad in pink gowns and white aprons, would clatter in with mops and pails, and proceed to swing the castered truckle beds out into the centre of the ward with a single heave of their brawny arms. When they had swept, scrubbed, dusted, and polished every square inch of wood and metal, so that wood shone like glass, and metal gleamed like silver and gold, beds would be pushed into position against the wall, and the patients given their breakfast. Having never been interested in food, I remember of the hospital meals only the unpleasant thickness of the china mugs from which we drank our well-diluted milk. Breakfast finished, faces and hands were washed, ear passages and nostrils cleaned. Finally, our beds were made, the coarse white sheets being turned back halfway down the bed and tucked in so tightly that the mattress curved like a bow. Christmas morning found me eagerly untying the parcel Father had left in the hall the night before. Though it contained all manner of good things, including books and toys, I remember best of all the two sour red plums he had tucked into a corner of the box. In spite of our protests and even tears, we were not allowed to keep our presents, all of which went into the common toy box in the bathroom. While the cheerful faces and friendly voices of the two cleaners are still vivid in my mind, of the nurses, with the exception of the ward sister, I remember nothing. They were, as no doubt they had been trained to be, machines for taking temperatures and administering medicines, though human hearts must have beaten somewhere beneath those starched bosoms. The ward sister was very pretty and severe almost to the point of spitefulness. She it was who, every evening before he went to sleep, pencil in hand, and with the face of a Medusa, held an investigation into the state of our bowels during the day, giving a tick in the register if they had moved, and a zero and a glass of syrup of senna if they had not. Constipation, we were made to feel, was a criminal offence. On one occasion, when I had tremblingly admitted for the third day in succession that I had had no motion, she scolded me harshly and told me to go to the lavatory and sit there until my recalcitrant bowels had moved. Fortunately, not all my hospital experiences were as unpleasant. On my return from the chickenpox ward, where I was isolated for a week with three or four other boys, I was allowed to spend most of the day out of bed. One morning, the other convalescent boys and I were taken downstairs into the courtyard, where we played for an hour in the pallid brightness of the winter sunshine, under the guardianship of the oldest patient, a lad of 12. When confined to the ward, we amused ourselves sliding up and down the highly polished floor in our stockinged feet. But my pleasantest memory is of the hours we spent singing together underneath the arches, Shantytown, and the rest of the Flanagan and Allen songs, then at the height of their popularity. While I was in hospital, only one boy died. We had been aware for several days that he was more seriously ill than the other patients, for when the doctors came, screens were placed around his bed, and once to our horror we saw several yards of rubber piping disappearing behind the green curtains of the screens. One day two figures, muffled in red cloaks and hoods, came and sat with him for an hour. That night, when only a dim blue light burned in the ward, and the night sister sat writing at the table, I saw shadowy figures flitting between his bed and the door. They seemed to be carrying something heavy. In the morning, when the screens were dismantled, we saw that the boy was no longer there. On the day of my discharge, one of the nurses took Mother aside and told her that my exceptionally high pulse rate, which had always been attributed to my well-known fear of doctors, might be due to some other cause. She advised her to take me to our own doctor and have my heart thoroughly tested. Alarmed, my parents had this done without delay, and it was discovered that I apparently had valvular disease of the heart. Years later, there was considerable controversy between medical men over the cause of my complaint. According to some of them, it was due to my having had rheumatic fever in very early childhood. Our own doctor, however, to whom I had been taken for every cough and cold since I was born, maintained that I had never had rheumatic fever. In my own opinion, the disease was functional, that is, of psychological origin. After I went to India and took up the practice of Buddhist meditation, which calms the mind and helps resolve complexes, there was a marked improvement in my condition. Whatever the origin of the disease might have been, about the way in which it was to be treated, the general practitioner had in those days no doubts. I was ordered to bed, where I had to remain flat on my back. Thenceforward I saw only the nasturtium-patterned walls of my room, where, hour after hour, for 2 years, I watched the eyes of the owl clock moving backwards and forwards, with a sharp click-clack, as the pendulum swung to and fro. Since I had to be kept absolutely quiet, no visitors were admitted. I saw only the doctor, who, at the beginning, came thrice a day, the district nurse, and my parents. Once, Joan, finding the door open, peeped in with a scared face. A few months prior to my catching scarlet fever, I had been promoted to the junior department at school, and my teacher, a red-faced, kind-hearted little woman, unwilling to suffer my education to be discontinued, offered to teach me spelling and arithmetic in her spare time. But when it was found that these lessons agitated me, they were stopped. During the whole period of my confinement, my parents were continually occupied by two problems: how to keep me quiet and how to keep me occupied. The first problem, the solution of which was the more urgent, inasmuch as my life was thought to depend upon it, could be solved by such measures as not allowing me ever to sit up in bed by my own exertions, and by excluding visitors and shutting out noise. The second, it was soon discovered, could be solved by providing me with books and magazines, and I promptly developed a habit of avid and incessant reading, which never afterwards left me. Soon after my incarceration began, Father brought into my room an armful of books from his own library and arranged them in the little bookcase on the wall, on top of which stood the model yacht White Eagle, given me by Nana for my 7th birthday. Some of Father's books I had already read, in addition to An Outline of English Church History and a pocket Johnson's Dictionary, both of which, like Prayer and Praise at Eventide, had belonged to my grandfather. There were Harrison Ainsworth's The Tower of London, E. W. Hornung's Raffles, Walter Besant's The World Went Very Well Then, Peter the Whaler, Tom Brown's School Days, Kingsley's Hypatia, Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre, and an illustrated English reader, besides others now forgotten. This odd collection of books, every one of which I read and reread, laid the foundation of my education, for neither before nor after my illness was I able to learn at school anything that could be considered either useful or interesting. Like the baby cuckoo, which keeps its sparrow foster parents flying to and fro all day with food for its insatiable maw, I gave my parents no respite from the search for reading matter. Immediately after breakfast, Father would dash round the corner to the newsagent's and bring me back a Boy's Weekly, one of which was published every day. My favourite was The Wizard, published on Monday, with The Adventurer, Hotspur and Rover following not far behind. The Champion, which appeared on Thursday, stood low in favour, for it consisted mainly of stories with a sporting background, while the famous Gem and Magnet, which contained nothing but rather silly stories about boys in Eton jackets and masters in billowing gowns — the gowns always billowed in those stories — I considered not worth reading. My preference was for the exotic. The indefatigable writers who, week after week, turned out the latest enthralling instalment of the serials which I followed with so much interest, catered for the natural boy's craving for adventure by exploiting three distant parts of the globe: darkest Africa, tom-toms and cannibalism; the Wild West, cattle rustling and scalping; and the mysterious East, tongs, opium fiends, six-inch fingernails, and throwing hatchets. One serial, however, had a Dayak headhunter for a hero, while in another, Tibetan lamas in tall hoods and with steel-devouring termites concealed in the seams of their robes, came to England and gained hypnotic control over a Champion football team as a means of raising money for their government. Of all the stories, it was the ones about the mysterious East that most excited my interest and stimulated my imagination. And I had not been many months in bed when I wrote a story of my own, set in the same opium-laden atmosphere of warring tongs and international smuggling rings, where fatal hatchets suddenly flashed through the air from silken sleeves, and men who had talked were dragged out of the river by the police. This story was my first literary effort. No doubt Father read it, and perhaps he thought that vicarious escapes from sudden and violent death were not the best thing for valvular disease of the heart, and I did no more writing. Out of the dozen or so books he had given me, my greatest favourites were Jane Eyre and Hypatia. I can still see the narrow black figure of Mr. Brocklehurst astride Mrs. Reed's hearthrug, still hear him ordering Jane's naturally curly hair to be shorn as a rebuke to worldly vanity, after which awful sentence his wife and daughters, exquisite satire, come rustling into the room in all the splendour of their silk and satin and glory of false fronts and flowing ringlets. No less vividly do I remember the haughty Miss Blanche at the piano, Mr. Rochester making his unconventional declaration, and the mad wife escaping from her chamber at midnight to rend Jane's bridal veil. In fact, almost every incident in this extraordinary novel, which 10 years later I could still read with enjoyment, is printed indelibly on my mind. Much less vivid is Hypatia, which as literature merely flutters its wings where Jane Eyre soars with ease, though strong impressions of this tale of the best of paganism and the worst of Christianity in naked conflict still remain. My sympathies were very much with the last of the Neoplatonists, and I was unspeakably shocked when the Christian mob, incited by Cyril the Archbishop, tore her to pieces on the altar steps of the great basilica beneath the very eyes of Christ. But even more deeply than by this tragic incident, I was impressed by Hypatia's address to her students, in the course of which I heard for the first time the thunder roll of Homeric verse, and by the description of her lying rigid upon her couch, while her soul flew alone to the alone. This was my first acquaintance with mystical religion, and was never to be forgotten. Religion in any form had not indeed occupied a very prominent place in my early life. Though baptized soon after birth into the Church of England, to which Father's family belonged, I had never been made to comply with any form of religious observance. For a short while, Joan and I attended Sunday school at a nearby congregational church, sitting on a hard bench against the wall in the bottom class, and feeling extremely bored. More interesting was my first service, from which I returned to tell my parents that I had seen the Holy Ghost. Inquiry revealed that this phenomenon was in fact the minister, who had appeared in a white surplice. My parents' indifference to religious observances was due, I think, not so much to any deficiency of religious instinct on their part, as to the lifeless formalism which seemed to have blighted all the churches, chapels, tabernacles, and meeting-houses of Tooting. The only sign of spiritual life to be discerned in our neighbourhood were the grey-haired Salvation Army lasses, who, in poke bonnets and with banners bearing such legends as "Jesus died for you," stood under the leadership of an aged captain outside the Trafalgar public house every Sunday morning, and in cracked voices sang doleful hymns to the squeak of a concertina and the rattle of tambourines. Father always gave them a copper, for though, like most Londoners, he could not agree with their religious opinions, he respected them for their integrity and for the nobility of their social work. Only once do I remember seeing a clergyman in the street. This was the Congregational minister, who, like Mr. Chadband, wore black and was a fat yellow man, who looked as though he had a great deal of train oil in his system. Probably this clerical elusiveness helped give me the feeling which, during the present century, has become almost universal in Protestant countries, that religion is the business of the clergy, and that its manifestations are confined in space to the churches, and in time to Sunday mornings and evenings. At any rate, no clergyman was ever known to visit the house, and only after removal to another part of Tooting did we become the object of ministerial solicitude. When orthodoxy decays, heterodoxy flourishes, and in the absence of more solid spiritual nourishment, Father turned to the ancient and mystical order of Druids, of which he became a member, and to Dr. Couet's New Thought, while Mother turned to the Rechabites. My first experience of a religious gathering took place under the auspices of this obscure sect, whose principal tenet was teetotalism. I accompanied Mother to a meeting at the suggestion of one of her friends, the mother of a classmate of mine, who said, "Oh, Gerald simply loves Rechabites." I did not love them. All they did was to sit gloomily around a table in a small room in Balham, while an elderly man read aloud from a black Bible, after which they drank cups of strong tea. Perhaps they said prayers too, but I do not remember any. Mother was probably as dissatisfied as I was, for she soon stopped going. When I was older, she dabbled in spiritualism and attended seances with a friend. Later, she joined the Baptist Church at Streatham, which for a time occupied an important place in my own religious life. And still later, under her son's guidance, she became mildly interested in Buddhism. Beneath these changes in religious affiliation, her basic attitude remained unaltered. Nothing that anyone was reported to have said or done, however wicked, ever roused her indignation, or made her feel, even when she had herself been wronged, that they should be punished by human hand. In her opinion, the consequences of one's actions were inescapable, and he who did evil inevitably suffered. At the same time, she never alluded to God, whom one born a Christian might be expected to regard as a rewarder of good and punisher of evil, from which I conclude that she believed in a principle not unlike the Buddhist karma, according to which pleasant and painful sensations arise in natural dependence upon pure and impure mental states respectively, without the intervention of any external agency. Having nothing to do except read, the rapidity with which I could devour a book became quite alarming. I must have held the world record for a boy of my age. How many words one issue of The Wizard or Hotspur contained, I no longer recollect. But I remember boasting to Father, who had fondly imagined that one of them sufficed me for a whole day, that it had lasted 25 minutes exactly by the owl clock. Instead of being pleased with my precocity, he looked dismayed. It was rather as though the baby cuckoo, after swallowing a particularly fat and juicy worm, which its overworked foster parents had thought would satisfy its demands for the day, should immediately open its beak and declare itself still hungry. Fortunately, the problem was solved by the next-door neighbours. This kind-hearted couple, a printer and his wife, who had passed their everybody's over the fence to us every day, every week for several years, now gave me a complete set in 61 parts of Harmsworth's Children's Encyclopedia. This was a sizable morsel even for a digestion like mine, and it kept me fairly quiet for the remainder of the 2 years. Alfred Harmsworth, afterwards Lord Northcliffe, has sometimes been ridiculed on account of his enthusiasm for popular education. But I fervently blessed him for the Children's Encyclopedia. All 61 parts, including the index, were at my bedside day and night, and rarely was I seen without one of them in my hand. Thanks to Mr. Harmsworth, I was no longer alone in my little room with the nasturtium-patterned wallpaper, the owl clock, the model yacht, and my 12 oft-read volumes. Now could I speak with the good and wise of all ages. I could follow nature into her innermost recesses, and explore all her secrets, from the constitution of the heavens to the structure of a crystal. The pageant of history from its first dawnings in Egypt, China, and Babylonia, passed with all its kings and princes, its priests and nobles, and common people, before my eyes. The buskined and unbuskined heroes of ancient and modern tragedy trod my bedside rug for their stage. Perseus slew Medusa the Gorgon, Hercules performed his 12 labours, and Jason went in search of the Golden Fleece in my sight. Shining presences of marble and bronze rose as though to music, and stood before me in the naked glory of their perfectly proportioned Hellenic manhood. Pensive Italian Madonnas smiled. The cross on which Christ was crucified, the tree beneath which the Buddha attained enlightenment, had their roots in the floor of my room, wherein, as into a garner, the harvest of the ages was gathered unto me for the making of the bread that would keep my soul alive. The body was forgotten, and my imagination, now possessed of infinite riches in a little room, rejoiced in the freedom of all the heavens of the spirit. Though not a page of those 61 parts remained unread, it was inevitable that some subjects had interested me more than others. My favourite sections, to which I returned most frequently, and over which I lingered longest, were the ones dealing with art, with history, and with literature, or rather with the history of literature. For the Children's Encyclopedia, being not a thesaurus of select classics, but an outline of knowledge in all its branches, the only species of literature actually represented was poetry, to which a separate section was devoted. Strangely enough, the philosophy section, which discussed abstract ideas such as truth, beauty, goodness, and justice, all of which the editor had stoutly capitalised, failed to awaken in me the love of wisdom, though I studied with interest the lives of the great philosophers, as well as those of the Buddha, Muhammad, Zoroaster, Confucius, and Lao Tzu. Archaeology, however, fascinated me, especially that of ancient Egypt, and I never wearied of looking at the picture of a pharaoh with red-brown face in profile, his hair done up in slender braids, the double crown of Upper and Lower Egypt on his head, and the crook and flail, symbols of protection and punishment, crossed over his linen-clad breast. Nor of gazing at those pages from the Book of the Dead, with their green Osiris and black-headed Anubis, or at the fresco of the fowler poised, sling in hand, upon his little boat among the reeds and lotuses, while the ducks flew up above his head. The section which attracted me least was popular science, perhaps because I had no means of performing even the simplest of the experiments described. Neither was I particularly interested in the circulation of the blood or in the internal combustion engine. Perhaps at this period I was more strongly attracted by beauty than by either truth or goodness. Certainly I was never tired at looking at what were to me the most precious parts of the whole encyclopedia, the numerous plates, some of them in full colour, which illustrated the history of art, especially of painting and sculpture, in ancient Greece and Rome, Italy, France, England, Germany, Spain, and Holland. Though every picture gave me pleasure, I admired most of all the works of the Renaissance artists, especially the deific sublimity of Michelangelo and the dancing delicacy of Botticelli. Towards the end of the second year of my confinement, my parents started giving even more serious thought to my condition than before. If I was no worse, neither was I noticeably any the better, and they could not help wondering whether I was doomed to lifelong invalidism, like white-faced Aunt Fanny at Bisthorpe, who had not been outside her room for 20 years. In these circumstances, it was only natural that they should feel the advisability of having a second medical opinion. Another doctor, therefore, was called in, and after examining me, he confirmed our own physician's diagnosis and recommended continuation of the regimen already prescribed. Still dissatisfied, Father made arrangements for me to be examined by the famous heart specialist, Dr. Mackenzie. As he bore me into the consulting room, Dr. Mackenzie asked, "Why are you carrying him? Let him walk." "He can't walk," explained Father, for to such a degree had I lost the use of my legs that I could not even stand. "Can't walk?" roared the cardiologists. "He must be made to walk. Put him down! Put him down!" Whether his diagnosis agreed with that of the other doctors, I have no knowledge. All I know is that he told Father in the strongest possible terms that I should be got out of bed immediately and allowed to run about. 20 years later, in Calcutta, I met a Bengali doctor, also a heart specialist, who had studied under Dr. Mackenzie. After hearing my story, he told me that this great cardiologist had revolutionised the method of treating diseases of the heart, and that after considerable initial opposition, his findings had won general acceptance. At my Bengali friend's request, I allowed him to examine my heart, which he pronounced perfectly sound. When Dr. Mackenzie gave his unexpected verdict, he was regarded as daringly, even dangerously, heterodox by the majority of the members of a profession which attaches as much importance to its own special form of orthodoxy as the most zealous religionists do to theirs. In this conflict of expert opinion, Father had no means of judging who was right and who wrong. Eventually, after much anxious thought, he took the responsibility into his own hands and resolved to follow a middle course. No doubt this was a difficult decision, the making of which required not only common sense but courage. But in neither of these two qualities was Father at any time deficient. Mother, in her distress, consulted an occultist. Gazing into a crystal ball, he said that he saw me ascending a flight of golden stairs and disappearing over the top.